Institute, Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, market value plays a big role in how much stuff can be recycled. We'll talk about the business of recycling and why our guest says big makers of materials should have a bigger role in managing things once they become waste. First, President Biden signed an executive order last Friday creating a commission to study the U.S. Supreme Court. The 36-member commission will examine the possible impact of adding seats to the nation's highest court and setting term limits for justices. The court has been the focus of partisan politics forever, in some ways, and for sure during the last couple of presidential terms. Our guest is here for a look at the impact that these changes could have on the judicial process and future cases that come before the court. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see some kind of changes in the U.S. Supreme Court? Are you happy to hear the Biden administration looking at the possibilities? Should more justices be added? What do you think of the idea of term limits for Supreme Court justices? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Charlie Jacobs is a professor of public law, judicial process, and American politics at St. Norbert College. Charlie, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
We've got this commission. Now, no change is being made. A bunch of people are being brought together to study these ideas. What do you think of the idea, first of all, of convening this, 36-member panel here?
Well, I might describe this panel, this commission, as sort of an empty suit commission. I'm not sure exactly whether or not the Biden administration is sort of in a full-throated way behind the proposals that even the commission has been created to try to discuss, because even on the campaign trail last year, he was very reluctant as a candidate to wed himself to any particular approach to the Supreme Court, at one point even saying, I know whatever I say is just going to wind up on the front pages of the newspaper, and that's all they're going to talk about. So I think he's a little reluctant, and it's politics, but I think it's also his experience. One has to remember that he was chair of the Judiciary Committee in the Senate, famously during the hearings regarding Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill. And so I think he knows exactly how much politics has invaded this sphere. And I think there's some reluctance to sort of dive into the deep end of this partisan pool and have an argument about whether or not to add seats to the court. And that's, I also think, why he sort of larded down the commission's purpose with some other sort of tangential issues related to reforming the court, giving the commission sort of an out in case they decide not to add seats to the United States Supreme Court as part of their proposal.
Let's look at the number of Supreme Court justices. There's nothing magical about the number 9. It's not in the Constitution, but it's been very controversial since we've had 9 when people come along and try to replace it, including Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Can you talk about why we seem to be sticking with this 9 number?
You know, I think that Justice Stephen Breyer just last week reminded us of some of the pitfalls regarding this. Any change to the court is going to be perceived as some sort of partisan leverage to gain in the policy outcomes that are created by the court. I mean, we've had 9 justices for more than a century and a quarter. The last time there was significant discussion about changing it was in 1937 when, frustrated by a court that was primarily conservative members who were thwarting his attempt to pass some significant legislation during the Great Depression. You know, FDR decides to try to add 6 new justices, the argument being, well, once you hit the age of 70, you kind of should be put out to pasture as a justice because you can't do the job. So every time somebody hits 70, a bell will ring and the president will be able to appoint an additional person. Of course, that would have immediately added 6 new justices up to 15, and it would have given FDR the room to pass the kind of legislation that he wanted. But, of course, even in a favorable political environment for him, I mean, he had won, you know, over 98% of the Electoral College votes in 1936. He still couldn't muster support in the U.S. Senate or the U.S. House in significant numbers for this. So people see this as an issue of legitimacy. If people believe the court has turned into a partisan vehicle, will we actually follow their rulings? Will we believe that their interpretation of the law is correct?
Now, President Biden's facing pressure from the progressive wing, the left of his party, whatever you want to call it, who's saying, hold on, the court is already politicized, pointing at the delay on the Merrick Garland then Supreme Court nominee, now Attorney General, holding that off and running out the clock on President Obama, and then the appointments by President Trump, including one just before the election. Can you talk about the pressure from progressives along those lines saying, hey, horse is already in the barn on partisan politics. Let's put some more justices on.
I mean, I think this is one of those tightropes that Biden has to walk here, especially in the honeymoon period of his administration, these sort of first 100 days out of the gate. And so he's got to be cognizant of the fact that this is a constituency that he needs to please. I'm not sure this is the area in which he wants to exhaust a whole lot of political capital. That's why I think that this commission, sort of a dog and pony show, but I think that there's some strategic approaches that the president is taking to mollify the progressives if necessary. And he actually got some help from something known as the Judicial Conference of the United States, which is really the policymaking wing of the judicial branch. It was created in the 1920s, and they offer Congress some ideas about how they can help reform the courts. And one of the big ones that they've just offered is adding nearly 80 lower court judges. And progressives might say, well, that's not the big fish we want. But the thing here is that, you know, the lower courts are kind of the AAA baseball of federal courts, which means you're priming people to take over seats. And because you have to remember, only about 75 cases get to the Supreme Court a year. What the lower court says matters a lot because they create substantive law. Now, again, this isn't really the suite that the progressives wanted, but at the same time, it gets them closer to the goal line that they hope for.
Talking to Charlie Jacobs, political scientist and court watcher at St. Norbert College, looking at this commission that the Biden administration created, looking at possible changes to the U.S. Supreme Court. What would be the impact? They're wondering of adding more justices, of adding term limits, maybe. You can join in at 800-642-1234. And let's bring on a caller now. Michael is with us in Pewaukee. Michael, hi.
Hey, I just had a few questions for, and I don't know the answers to this, but, you know, just the possibility or constitutionality of different options. I mean, I know, like, right now we have 13, and correct me, is it 13 circuit courts or federal courts right now, like, which are kind of, like you said, the minor leagues. Would it be possible to have one Supreme Court justice for every single circuit court that we had? Because I know, like, originally there weren't, you know, there were not, I don't say originally, but there were nine when there were nine Supreme Court justices. But over the years, we've added like three to four more. So would that be a possibility? And also, what's the constitutionality around something where we might begin to have a law where each president in their 4-year term gets to appoint one Supreme Court? Rotating, so, you know, over the course of the next 36 years, you might have
Michael, you're breaking up, but we got your questions there. Charlie, first of all, the idea of having the number of Supreme Court justices match up to the number of the highest lower courts.
So certainly that could happen, and that's a legislative fix rather than a constitutional fix. I think it provides justification for adding additional justices, but I mean, I'm impressed by Michael because that's an arcane fact, and I think it would be lost on most individuals in the country, and it would seem like maybe an inapt kind of justification for adding justices. Again, I think it's a perfectly reasonable proposal, but I'm not sure that in particular Republicans and conservatives would find it reasonable. When it comes to sort of a rotating justice, if what Michael means is somebody comes off to add one for an incoming president, the difficulty there is that the Constitution prescribes life tenure for the justices. And so it would require a constitutional amendment to end the justices' term. And I hope that was the question that Michael was offering.
Yeah, and Michael brought up that point of an even number of appointments by president. And I've talked to guests who want that constitutional amendment or want some sort of informal agreement that in effect makes the term limits. The argument there, Charlie, is we end up with this absurd system where, you know, an 80-something-year-old decides they can't retire yet because they don't want this president to replace them, or an appointment goes one way or another depending on how long, say, a very old Supreme Court justice with health conditions, if they live until before or after Inauguration Day. I don't know. Is there some kind of cure for some of those absurd outcomes?
I think the most obvious one is to create some sort of term limit, which is something that the commission has been tasked with discussing. And of course, this isn't something that is wholly unusual. A lot of state high courts require this. there are, I mean, most state high courts are elected, and so there's input in a democratic fashion by the public. Again, but all of these are going to require some sort of constitutional amendment. And, you know, just looking at a map of red states versus blue states, I'm not sure whether or not either red or blue states would be among the two-thirds necessary to add that, the three-quarters necessary to add a constitutional amendment. I mean, it wouldn't necessarily hurt one more than the other, but really right now the ox that would get gored are Republicans and conservatives, who would see more members of the court coming off who are older in sort of their partisan persuasion. And so it just, all of it is just a hot partisan mess that is hard to overcome because of the environment we're in right now.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Charlie Jacobs, professor of public law, judicial process, and American politics at St. Norbert College. We're talking about a new commission created by President Biden to look at possible changes to the U.S. Supreme Court, ideas like adding justices or trying to create some kind of term limit, also changes, more likely, our guest says, to lower courts as well. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like either of these ideas? Would you like to see President Biden and Senate Democrats try to add Supreme Court justices, or do you worry about what that would do? What do you think of the idea of term limits? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation now with political scientist Charlie Jacobs about President Biden's commission that will study ideas like adding U.S. Supreme Court justices or creating some kind of term limits. You can join in with your thoughts on either of those ideas at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Lisa is with us in Madison. Lisa, hi.
Hi, I'm wondering if the guest is aware whether or not the commission will be exploring the information gathered by Senator Whitehouse regarding dark money and its impact on the court, primarily via the Federalist Society, and how that also impacts the legitimacy of the court when there's concerns about dark money impacting their choices and decisions.
Lisa, thanks a lot for the call. And Charlie, yeah, a lot of money goes into supporting or opposing Supreme Court justices after their nominations. I don't think that's on this commission's agenda, but correct me if I'm wrong.
It's not specifically part of their agenda, but, you know, they have quite a bit of latitude to explore elements that they think are, you know, sufficient to help them make a particular argument for a policy decision. It is a concern. And the Federalist, it's not just about, you know, influencing after the nomination. It's about grooming individuals and creating avenues by which they get on courts that are necessary to then have an opportunity to be elevated. And then, of course, there are just the issues related to access to the court and the way in which certain groups seem to be able to leverage their ability to get what are called writs of certiorari or opportunities to present their cases to the court. So, I mean, there are some real concerns about what we're seeing lately. But the interesting thing, too, is that what we've been seeing in the last couple of years is the court itself abusing some of its internal rules. And Congress can alter those whenever it wants. And that is also an interesting question, one that's related to Lisa's, regarding whether or not, you know, Congress should step in and start to restrain the way in which the court itself develops its rules, picks cases, and how they go about deciding the outcome of these cases.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to Charlie next in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I am really concerned about this for a very simple reason. For a country that needs to get together and to unite, this is only going to divide people even farther. Again, it's kind of like changing the goalposts every time you want a different result. Harry Reid started this by doing the Chief Justice, or doing the appellate justices, and then they turned, the Republicans said, fine, we can do it too, and did it to the Supreme Court. And now it's going to be court packing, and before you know it, we're going to have a very large court system that has just no single voice that we can all rally around. Again, this does not appear to be a checks and balances, but rather a means to just get your own way and cause further division. And I hope we don't go through with it.
Thanks a lot for the call. Charlie, other Charlie sees adding justices to the court as just an escalation that's going to be even more divisive.
Yeah, and I think that's why there's trepidation on behalf of Biden and the administration, because they know how ugly this could get and how quickly it could get very ugly. And I want to clarify something, because Sir Charlie brought this up in his response. One of the things to keep in mind about the suggestion about the addition of judges in the lower courts, certainly that is going to create a partisan advantage, because it creates opportunities for Biden to appoint individuals at the lower court and groom individuals for the high court. But one thing you have to realize is there hasn't been a significant bill to alter any of the lower courts and add a significant number of judges since 1990. And just with a growing population, it means a growing number of cases that come to these courts. There are a couple of judgeships that are dealing with docket sizes of 900 or more cases, which is just unsustainable. It means that we can't achieve justice. And I think that's one reason why Biden is going to focus on this, because he can make that argument. To get your day in court, we need more judges. And wink, wink, nod, nod to progressives. We also get some more bodies on the court to help shape the outcome of law.
Thanks for the call, Charlie. And Charlie Jacobs, for those lower courts, I mean, couldn't there be a bipartisan way to do this, to say, yes, we've got this workload backlog, we're going to add more judges, but we're going to do some of them during this presidential term and some in the next presidential term, and we'll see which president that is, and maybe some the one after that, so it isn't we've created all these new judges and Biden gets them all?
That would be a terrific compromise that hopefully gets both sides to the middle here and makes some progress. I mean, the Chief Justice is responsible for the Judicial Conference of the United States, and he typically has to tromp on over to Capitol Hill to make an argument about budgets and other policy decisions. And you can almost hear when he does testify the exasperation in his voice, because he knows the people he manages in the lower courts are exhausted. And people who retire then go on what's known as senior status as judges, and they are asked to sit on cases in their 80s, 90s. And not too long ago, we had a senior status judge who was over 100 years old. I mean, we need to have some bipartisanship to achieve some outcomes, to achieve justice in these courts.
All right. Without the more controversial stuff like the Supreme Court, is there an appetite, Charlie, for a middle ground bipartisan solution to help out with this court backlog, just in our last minute or so?
I think that there is, and here's one of the mechanisms of the nominations by the president. For lower court judges, they lean on home state senators in district courts to help make suggestions. Well, that's political. So if I'm a red state senator who's a Republican, I would make a suggestion to the president, and that wins me political capital. The more district court judges, the more I am able to exercise that political capital and gain some clout in my own state. So that may be a carrot that attracts some Republicans to compromise on this particular issue.
Charlie, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for being with us today.
Pleasure being here.
That's Charlie Jacobs, professor of public law, judicial process, and American politics at St. Norbert College. He joined us today for a look at President Biden's Supreme Court Reform Commission. WPR and Wisconsin Watch are documenting the lives of Wisconsinites in this unprecedented time with a series of audio diaries called Outbreak Wisconsin. After a year of reflecting on the trauma of the COVID-19 pandemic, the Song of Spring has prompted ER nurse Mariah Clark to do some introspection about a life after the pandemic.
I'm walking out of the hospital at 4:30, 5 a.m., It was a long shift. I had to stay late. And I'm hearing the first bird song I've heard in months. As we begin to ramp up our vaccinations and more Wisconsinites become vaccinated and have the vaccine available to them, there's a definite feeling of seeing the twilight before dawn, having hope, knowing that if nothing else, at least we'll be able to hang outside comfortably again soon. You know, spring has never felt so spring-like and primal. And I think this year probably people were more maybe aware of winter as a season of death and spring as a season of rebirth. it's got me thinking about the end of the pandemic as sort of a tenuous prospect, as a vague idea. You know, I heard something recently about how people just can't grasp big numbers. And this year has really rubbed that in a little bit. I've lost track of how many of my close friends I've lost to COVID. I have to go back and check, you know, social media posts to remember, because of course there weren't any funerals to mark it. I've definitely lost count of how many patients I've lost. And while there's been plenty of bright spots, I have to know that I have kind of lost track of the numbers, just like everybody else. And I know that nobody who didn't deal with COVID day in and day out, constantly faced with it in all of its ugly truth daily, is gonna ever really grasp what it was like. And I don't know if in 5 years it'll seem like this was better than it was or worse than it was in memory and recollection, but I know that there are stories I will never forget this year, my own and other people's. So when people share, listen.
To hear more stories like this one, visit WPR.org/outbreakWisconsin. Recycling has been around as a concept for quite a while. It seems easy enough to do our part as a consumer, separating what's recyclable from our other waste. But are we doing it right? Are we recycling the right stuff, or are we wish-cycling? And are there changes we need to make before we're figuring out how to throw something away? You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you ever feel confused about what you can and can't recycle? Do you go to greater lengths to recycle, sorting things extra, making an extra trip somewhere to get that stuff that you can't put out on the curb? Do you try to avoid buying things that are unrecyclable in the first place? And do you have questions about how it all works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Jenny Romer is a single-use plastic and recycling expert who helped write plastic bag bans in California and New York. She's a legal associate for the Surfrider Foundation's Plastic Pollution Initiative and has spent more than a decade as a lawyer working on plastic pollution laws. Her new book is called Can I Recycle This? A Guide to Better Recycling and How to Reduce Single-Use Plastics. Jenny, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, in your book, Jenny, you get into a lot of the nuts and bolts and specific things, but one big picture emerges and is consistent through your book. It seems like we can recycle a lot less plastic than I think we can. Why is that?
Right. Well, come on. Recycling is a commodities market. And so there's some plastic that's worth a whole lot. And there are buyers and there's an end market for it. So HDPE bottles and jugs, which is resin number two, that's worth almost $1,000 a ton on the commodities market. But three through sevens, that's the majority of what we see on the store shelves, that's only worth about -$17 a ton. So really, if there's no end market, no one that wants to buy all this stuff that we put in our bins, there's not so much of a point of trying to recycle it. So that's a lot of what I try to get across in the book, is that plastic isn't just one thing. So we need to think about that a little bit differently.
Before we get to the stage where we agonize about can I recycle this or not, Jenny, are there changes you'd like to see in the manufacturing process so that, the stuff that isn't ultimately going to be recycled doesn't end up on that shelf in the first place?
Definitely. And that's a big take home from the book. You know, I really want people to know what happens after they put items in their bin. But a big take home is policy. And so at the state level, we're seeing a lot of extended producer responsibility laws. People call them EPR laws, where it would make the manufacturers responsible for the cost of recycling and disposal and cleanup of products. And that makes it so that there's a lot of incentives to create more sustainable, more truly recyclable items that end up on store shelves. And then kind of a bigger picture take home is at the federal level, the Break Free from Plastic Pollution Act that includes that type of policy, but then really looks at the whole life cycle of plastics and other materials.
And you have a lot of focus, it makes it into your subtitle, on single-use plastics. What kind of things are you looking at and why are they of particular concern to you?
Well, my background, as you mentioned, is in plastic bag laws. It's something I kind of stumbled across when I was in law school in San Francisco, and plastic bags were initially being banned there. And I started a website about it right after law school because the plastics industry was just super organized about lobbying to not have those laws pass. And I saw kind of internal PowerPoints where they saw it as a gateway to broader restrictions on plastics. And so I really got involved there and helped pass a lot of policies and really figured out what works and what doesn't as far as banning plastic bags or putting a fee on plastic bags. And then really learned a lot more about how the recycling system works. And plastic bags in particular are tanglers in curbside recycling programs. So they end up tangling a lot of that sorting machinery. So not only do they not really have an end market, no one really wants to buy those bags that end up in the curbside bins, but they also cause a lot of havoc at recycling facilities. So that's one thing that we look to really reduce rather than recycle.
Talking to Jenny Romer about her new book, Can I Recycle This? A Guide to Better Recycling and How to Reduce Single-Use Plastics. You can join in with your thoughts and your questions at 800-642-1234. All right, Jenny, let's take us to a kind of question that I know you get asked a lot, the Can I Recycle This? And often, and I'll speak for myself, I've been in that position, I'm not sure, it's in that gray area. I'm best off erring on the side of caution. I'll put it in the recycling bin. And if it's no problem, if they can't recycle, they'll just take it out. I'm making the wrong decision, it sounds like. Tell me why.
Well, it depends. I really want people to get to know their local recycling rules. So your local jurisdiction has made decisions about what they want to accept in the bin. For example, in New York City accepts all rigid plastics in their residential curbside bins, but they know that they can only really sell a certain portion of them. And so they'll accept everything to make it easy for the consumer. And they know that they are not going to have a buyer for quite everything. But then some jurisdictions will only accept number one and number two bottles and jugs because they know there's a market for that. So first thing, pay attention to what your facility wants you to recycle. But then all this book really helps you get to know what happens next. So to make better choices when you're at the market, when you're making purchases, to not buy things or try to avoid as much as you can buying things that are not recyclable and really avoiding those things that are tanglers that really hurt the recycling system.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Oconomowoc. Mike, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. The one thing I noticed after moving back here from North Carolina was how limited Wisconsin has recycling programs and how difficult it is to recycle so many things that when I was in North Carolina was very easy to recycle, particularly electronics. There's just doesn't seem to be any place to take anything, whereas down there was a very well-networked recycling system throughout the whole Charlotte and Raleigh areas that made it very easy for people to bring recyclables, divide them up themselves, and take them to the appropriate places rather than just putting them in a blue bin and hoping that they make it through the recycling system.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. And I know that varies not just from state to state, but from, you know, city to city here in Wisconsin. Jenny, can you talk about why communities might be making different decisions and offering different options?
Sure. Well, a lot of it depends on policy. So some states have zero waste goals at the state level that determine that could put requirements then on the local level for what they kind of what recycling goals they need to meet. So that has a lot to do with it. A lot of it depends on the kind of the political will or what's happening at the local level and where you live. But another thing is that recycling can be expensive. It depends on what you're trying to recycle. But sometimes if your local recycler isn't making money in the process, for a long time, municipal recyclers were making money by selling low value plastics or electronics that were being shipped abroad. But now we're seeing more regulation and really a lot more eyes on that issue as far as really that it's a humanitarian issue when we're sending our electronics or our low value plastics abroad. So some places are doing it or are not accepting them because they're not going to be recycled domestically. So that's one thing to look at. But I would say that generally it's something that is going to be decided probably at the state level, how much you're seeing kind of trickle down to the local level in most places.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Paul now in Delafield. Paul, hi.
Howdy. Thanks for taking my call. So one of the things we do, we do like to recycle, but one of the things that I see happening is that when they pick up the recycle things in their trucks, if it's not secured, like a lot of it blows around, and after recycle day, you see a bunch of plastic out in the lawns and stuff. So I end up putting my recycle stuff in plastic bags that I tie so they don't blow around. But is that a good habit, or should I get over that?
Paul, thanks for the call, Jenny.
I think you should try to get over it. It's, you know, something that maybe you can bring up with your local hauler, because it should have a way to capture those plastics before they get out into the environment from being hauled. But generally, like I said, plastic bags are tanglers at facilities. There are some facilities that who know they're going to get a lot of plastic bags regardless, or who require that you put your recyclables into plastic bags, particularly in really dense cities where there isn't room for what we call toters or garbage cans, recycling cans. And so in those places, there'll usually be kind of a vacuum suction at the beginning of a sorting line so that those plastics are kind of sucked off and held and taken out of the recycling stream. But most places, those plastic bags are kind of just going to get stuck in the machinery. So do your best to avoid it. And I would say if you want to make a difference, try to reach out to your hauler about that problem.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Jenny Romer about her new book. It's called Can I Recycle This? A Guide to Better Recycling and How to Reduce Single-Use Plastics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What burning recycling questions do you have about what can and can't be recycled and about how the recycling business works in general? And do you make an effort to buy things that you know can be reused or recycled as opposed to stuff you know you're going to end up throwing out? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. Right now, we're picking up our talk with single-use plastic and recycling expert Jenny Romer about her new book, Can I Recycle This? You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Jenny, before we go back to our caller, you introduced me to a new word in this book. You dig into the sort of the life cycle of recycling, including of plastic, the nurdle, N-U-R-D-L-E. What is a nurdle?
A nurdle is a pre-production plastic pellet. So it's what kind of the base for what plastic items are made from. And so that's nurdles have been in the news a bit lately because plastic production facilities have had very large nurdle spills. So even before plastic becomes an item and is used, they're getting into the environment just at the production level. And so there have been some laws proposed in Texas and other places to regulate them. So if you're at the beach sometime and you see, or even in the Great Lakes, if you see little tiny bits of plastic, it could be a nurdle.
Let's go back to our callers now. Colleen is with us in Madison. Colleen, hi.
Hello.
Hi, what'd you want to bring up, Colleen?
Well, I'm going to focus on two things. One is that I just came from California, where I was living for many years. I'm from Madison. And I would say I cannot take any credit, but the plastic bags in grocery stores was made illegal, and also styrofoam on takeout food was also prohibited in my town. But it seems like, and now that I have a word, it seems like the nurdle production is fixed, so that almost exactly at the same time, food that is in the grocery stores started to become present in pouches. So even like rice products that come in burlap or cloth sacks suddenly, or even paper, suddenly they were put into these pouches, and the pouches were, they had a photograph of a burlap bag or a cloth bag, like the Japanese rice, that would be printed on the plastic pouch. Hmm. These can't be recycled. Also, there's a trend, and especially in the town that I lived in, to have rows and rows of organic, blended, pure vegetables in pouches. And then when you go to the parks, you see the caps for these pouches and the pouches themselves thrown all about and in the garbage can.
Thanks a lot for the call. Jenny, Colleen says, hey, they got rid of the single-use plastic bags, but saw more and more products ending up wrapped in plastic.
Yeah, and that's really a worldwide phenomenon, the multi-layer pouches, particularly single-use multi-layer pouches. So just moving from buying in bulk or buying a 10-pound bag of something to buying smaller sizes and having it be in what we call multi-layer pouches. So there tend to be a couple different types of plastic and maybe some aluminum. And one general rule for recycling is if something is made from multiple materials, it's not going to be recyclable. If it's made from all these things, there's kind of one exception is milk cartons. Milk cartons tend to be some are made from kind of Tetra Paks, which are generally not recyclable except for the paper layer. And then the paper layer of regular milk cartons have a paper layer and then both plastic on both sides. And so only the paper fibers from those are recyclable. But for the most part, multi-layer pouches are a huge problem. You see them for baby food, and they're definitely not recyclable. And I agree with the caller. We're starting to address certain things, and we've gotten a really good handle on things like plastic bags and foam foodware, where those laws are allowed. But we're seeing a lot more single-use items on the grocery store shelves. And I will say, in Wisconsin, there is a preemption law in place at the state level. So local jurisdictions are not allowed to adopt plastic bag laws. So that's a whole other subject, but just to raise that. And that's something we've seen in about 18 states now, where the plastics industry, rather than dealing with these local laws popping up to put a fee or ban plastic bags or ban foam foodware, just going to the state level and blocking that. And I'll also say, I just completed a map of all plastic bag, foam, and straw laws in the U.S. At Surfrider. So if you go to Surfrider's website, there's a beautiful map of almost 1,000 laws that have been adopted in the U.S. to reduce single-use plastics.
Thanks for the call, Colleen. We'll go next to Pat in River West. Pat, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just recently watched, I came into this program late, but I recently watched a NPR show about the kind of the sham of the recycling emblem that makes us all feel good about the triangle with the 1, 2, 3, 4. And you feel better when you see they recycle all the numbers. But they said that was designed by the plastic petroleum companies in the 70s. And in their internal documents, it said that this won't be not implied. It won't be utilized because it just doesn't cost. It's not cost effective. It takes more energy and chemicals to recycle plastic. So really, plastic is it's getting cheaper and cheaper with these factories that make these plastic pellets and stuff. But it's a sham to utilize petroleum waste. And really, we should be going for glass or paper. I mean, I won't buy anything if it's the best chocolate or creamer in a plastic bottle. I don't buy plastic anymore. I'll buy a half as good, product in glass. You know, Annie's salad dressing, Oberweis chocolate milk. I will not buy. I'll starve before I buy something in plastic, or I'll never buy even another water bottle.
Thanks a lot for the call, Jenny. Pat seeking to use anything but plastic in his products.
Yeah, that's great to hear. And I really want to take home from the book for people to understand what's happening to these items and to make choices when they're at the supermarket and in other parts of their lives. And this book definitely gets into the history of the recycling, the chasing arrows symbol, and how the plastics industry has really spent so much money and so much effort, as that Frontline documentary talks about, really going into the plastics industry has spent millions of dollars over decades on marketing to make us feel really good about recycling when they knew the whole time that a lot of these things cannot actually be recycled. It's not an efficient system for the low value plastics. So my book really looks at kind of a three-step process that the Federal Trade Commission's guideline for whether something can be marketed as recyclable. And so that means it must be collected. That item must be collected in at least 60% of consumers would have access to collection. It would be sorted by existing infrastructure, and there would be an end market, a buyer, to make that into a new product. And so that's a pretty strict definition of recycling, but it is a very valid, accurate. I think everyone should think of recycling as, will someone buy this and manufacture it into a new product? And that documentary really looks at that as well.
Jenny, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Jenny Romer, legal associate for the Surfrider Foundation's Plastic Pollution Initiative. We talked to her today about her new book. It's called Can I Recycle This? A Guide to Better Recycling and How to Reduce Single-Use Plastics. Still time for you to share your recycling stories, the efforts you make to make sure things don't go to waste. You can do that online over on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can always tweet us at Central Time WPR.